Alice Hoffman has written more than 30 works of fiction, including The Marriage of Opposites, The Museum of Extraordinary Things, and Practical Magic, which was adapted into a popular film. Her new book is titled Faithful. She spoke yesterday at the Marcus JCC Book Festival and will give a talk tomorrow at the Margaret Mitchell House. Alice Hoffman is here now. Welcome to City Lights, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
The main character of Faithful is Shelby Richmond, who is severely depressed when we encounter her early in the story. Why is she incapable of functioning?
Oh, Shelby. She has had a terrible accident as a teenager. She feels responsible. She survived. Her best friend was very injured, and she's suffering from survivor's guilt. She's turning everything inside. All of her hatred, all of her fear is directed to herself.
Almost agonizing to read. Would you describe her relationship with her best friend, Helene?
Well, I think it was a relationship where Helene was kind of in charge, and Helene was the star of the relationship. And you know, it starts off in a very grim way, but really I think the book is about forgiveness and the ability for someone to forgive themselves.
And indeed, even though it starts out with this shocking accident, there's transformation, there is forgiveness, and there's a good bit of wry humor.
I mean, the funny thing is I feel that it's a very upbeat book, even though it's about tragic circumstances.
Absolutely. At the end, I thought, this is an uplifting story.
Yeah.
Well, in her flashbacks, we learn that Shelby wasn't really responsible for Helene's comatose state, and Helene was not the ideal girl she seemed. Why did Shelby never reveal that Helene refused to wear her seatbelt, that the only reason they were out driving was because of Helene's impulsiveness?
Because I think none of that mattered to her. She just saw herself as the person who was responsible. And I think sometimes that happens to us when horrible things happen and we can't explain it because life is such a mystery and, you know, we can't always know the reasons for things. You know, sometimes, especially as women, I think we turn it on ourselves. We should have known. We should have stopped it. We should have done better in situations when we couldn't have done anything.
Something that struck me particularly insightful was the way you write as a teenage girl, through the character of a teenage girl. And I wondered if you had any experience up close and personal with this sort of child?
I haven't had. What happened to Shelby has never happened to me. I've certainly had experience with trauma and loss and with blaming myself for things that have gone wrong in my life and in the world. I feel responsible for everything sometimes.
It's raining, Alice.
I know. It's my fault.
Well, of course.
That's kind of where I'm coming from. But I feel like, you know, I feel like that 16-year-old girl, and that's one of the great things about writing a novel is that you become the characters. I think it's a lot like it must be for an actor to take on a role and become this other person. And for me, you know, I was an escapist reader, and I'm an escapist writer, and so for me, it's a great pleasure to become someone else.
That is very much like an actor. Well, in her flashbacks, we learn that, indeed, Shelby wasn't really responsible, and now Helene has turned into this miracle girl. What do people attribute to her?
I think people want to feel that they can be healed and that they can speak to the mystery, even if they don't understand it. She's a mystery that is almost spiritual in nature, and they feel that maybe she can heal them. And I think that happens. You know, we wish and hope and want to have faith, and even when it seems impossible. And I think people go to her to be healed, and they believe that she can heal them.
And the fact that she was beautiful and takes on this beatific, you know, saintly sort of appearance certainly adds to it. Faithful doesn't display the type of magical realism that some of your other books reveal.
Yeah.
But this book comes close. Why is it Helene's role, that of a healer or the one who has magical powers? I mean, clearly by this time we know she's a flawed character.
Yeah. I think the truth of it is that the healing comes from within. It's the only place you can ever find healing. I'm not talking about, you know, medical healing or going to a doctor, but I mean spiritual healing. And when you've been traumatized, when you've gone through great loss, I think it's very difficult to find your way back. And that's what happens with Shelby. And at last she realizes she can only change the way she feels. That's the only thing she can change. And that's a hard lesson to learn, I think.
At any age.
Right.
It's painful to read about the extent of Shelby's self-punishment early in the story. How is she paying her penance?
Well, I think mostly by, you know, she shaves her head. She makes herself look as terrible as possible. She doesn't tell people about her trauma. She keeps everything inside. And, you know, I think a lot that's common for a lot of women and young girls, whether it's, you know, stopping eating or cutting yourself or, you know, it's self-directed. And that's what women tend to do when they're traumatized and upset.
Mm. Well, adding to the tragedy is Shelby's sexual abuse mm-hmm. by an orderly in the psychiatric hospital. And this ultimately leads to her rescue by her mother. Tell us about yeah. Sue Richmond.
Well, you know, I realized after I wrote the book that the book is really a love story between a mother and a daughter.
It really is.
And I think that's why it's so up. I mean, you know, there are grim things that happen, but in the center of this is this real love and this kind of bantering between the two of them. And, you know, Shelby's mother believes in her no matter what. No matter how difficult Shelby is, no matter what happens, her mother believes in her. And I really feel that if one person believes in you, it can completely change your life.
I mean, they like, you know, outside in the bitter cold, lying on the hood of the car and staring up at the stars together. This is one spectacular mother.
She is.
And, yeah.
But, you know, I have to say, I also had a mother who stood by me no matter what. So that, I do know what that's like. And Shelby's a very difficult daughter. I was a very difficult daughter. Maybe everybody is. I don't know. But I think, you know, Sue, her mother, really gets her through to the other side.
Absolutely. In fact, it's this association with Sue, with her mother, that, you know, finally makes enough of an impression on Shelby to react when she's being sexually abused by that evil orderly, because the same cleaner that he used, a cleaning agent, was one with the lavender scent, something that her mother used. And what you write, that the same cleaner Sue used unlocked a small part of her soul.
Mm.
Earlier, there was a passage describing Shelby lying on the ground after the car accident. A man covered her with a black coat and said she couldn't give up. Yeah. And you write, she was shivering and her soul was in her mouth, ready to escape as a puff of air, but the angel kept her on earth. There are references to the soul in various sections of the book. I stopped counting just how often the word appeared. Would you talk about the importance of the soul in this story?
You know, it's funny, I didn't realize that, but I think it is a book about having faith in yourself and who you are at your very core. You know, you can call it the soul, you can call it whatever you want to, but it's the essence of the person. And I think, you know, Shelby feels like she's losing that. She's lost that. Somehow she's lost her soul in this terrible trauma, but she hasn't at all. I mean, she's funny. She's a great friend. She's all these good things. She just doesn't see it, and she has to learn to see who she is.
I wondered if there was something personal in your belief in the soul that you were conveying through these characters.
Well, you know, I feel like I'm a searcher. I feel that when I write a book, it's not that I have answers, I have questions. So I have questions about the soul. I have questions about the mystery of life, about how people get through trauma, about how they manage to survive. So I feel like for me, writing a novel is trying to find the answer to these questions, which, and many of them are unanswerable.
There's also a mysterious element of the story that involves postcards. Talk about the postcards. Are they from the beyond?
Well, she gets these postcards from someone who seems to know her. And I think what's interesting about that is that I feel like basically that's what we all want. We want to feel that somebody knows us. And in a way, her getting the postcards, having it be the written word, is really, I think, symbolic for how we feel when we read, how we feel as readers when we read a book and we feel known, that the author knows us, that the book knows us. I certainly have felt that way about the books that I love most. You know, this really deep connection due to the written word. And that's what happens to Shelby. This mysterious person is sending her postcards, and even though she doesn't know who it is, she feels connected.
One of my very favorite quotes, you've just touched upon the essence of something that resonated with me. I read that when he was asked, why do people read books? Sartre said, people read books to see if they are in them.
I think that's true. That's so true.
And that is really the essence of what you're saying. Well, Shelby reengages with life initially by the way of her dope dealer.
Yes.
Which may not be every parent's dream for their kid to, you know, heal because of the dope dealer. But
he's a good guy.
He's a very good guy. Tell us about the role of Ben Mink.
Yeah, he's her friend. He does deal marijuana, but he then goes to pharmacy school. So he's legitimized.
It's a logical progression.
Right. Logical. But he's her good friend who kind of sees her through, and he's in love with her. And she loves him, but she's not in love with him. Mm-hmm. And so she looks for love in other places. Some are great places to look, and some are disasters.
Yeah. Well, another major step in Shelby's recovery occurs when she takes a job at a pet store.
Mm.
How does working at the pet store change Shelby's life?
Well, there she meets this woman who drags her into friendship. And this woman, Maribel, has three kids, and Shelby becomes part of their family. She doesn't want to, but she's just dragged into it. And she starts to have feelings, you know, and she starts to allow herself to have feelings. And the other thing, she gets very involved with dogs. And I always feel that dogs can change your life, you
yes.
know? Especially
yes.
rescue dogs. When you rescue something, you rescue yourself as well. And that's what happens to Shelby.
Yeah. Would you talk about the importance of rescue as a theme throughout this book on various levels?
Yeah, I really do believe that when you feel so down and you feel so oppressed and vulnerable, that the only way to really feel better is to help someone else. And that's what happens with Shelby. When she rescues these dogs, she feels her own power. She doesn't feel as vulnerable. She feels like she can make a change in the world, do something for someone, for something. And that's really the change. And I think a lot of times when there's a traumatic incident, they bring in these dogs kind of as healing dogs so that people can relate to the dogs when sometimes you can't relate to another person.
Indeed. And in the pet store, while she is still severely depressed and barely capable of interacting with anyone, Shelby connects with the bird song, and Maribel has yeah. a very beautiful voice. Am I overthinking it, or is Maribel the name like Marvel or Marvelous? I'm overthinking
well, that,
it.
Well, I don't know. It could be. You know, I always think that the reader knows a lot more than the writer.
I don't.
I don't know about that.
The answer is overthinking it. Well, indeed, those of us who love dogs, anyone who loves dogs will appreciate their importance in the story. Would you talk about the General and Blinky?
Yes, they're two dogs that Shelby rescues, her first rescue dogs, and she sees them in the park. And I actually had this experience of seeing, in my case, it was a dog and a cat that were constantly being used by different people when they were begging for money. Mm. And so I realized that the dog and the cat were props. And the General and Blinky are two dogs that are traded so that people can use them. And they're ill-treated, and Shelby just can't take it. She snaps. And it's her first kind of act of defiance, and she steals them.
In fact, much of what's meaningful to her, she steals in the book. Another poignant part is something I was hoping that you would read. I think it's on page 122.
Yes.
Would you just kind of set it up for us?
Yes. Well, this is where Shelby sees this girl who's been using the dogs, and now she has another creature. She has a cat, and it's raining, and the cat is, you know, sitting there in the rain, and Shelby snaps, and this is what happens. Shelby runs to 7th Avenue, to Penn Station. You rescue something, and you're responsible for it. But maybe that's what love is. Maybe it's like a hit-and-run accident. It smashes you before you can think. You do it no matter the cost, and you keep on running. It's dusk now, and puddles are filled with neon. It's the only 30 minutes by train to Valley Stream. Don't make a noise, Shelby whispers to the cat when the conductor comes around. Soon, you'll be sleeping on a velvet pillow. You'll be looking at the rain from behind the window where there are blue silk curtains, and you'll be glad there was a thief like me.
Mm. And then another important part of the book, really, I think, something of a revelation for Shelby occurs on page 107, the mm-hmm. last paragraph. She's stealing something off the wall.
She is. She's yes. She's had a bad relationship, and this is her reaction to the relationship. She goes in and steals the painting. The painting's heavy, but Shelby manages to get it down the hall. Leandro helps her by opening the door into the street. You okay, he says. I am, she assures him. Thank you. The painting fits neatly into the trunk of the taxi. It will probably be another $10 charge, but Shelby doesn't care. She wants to look at a field, a stream, a boulder, a blue sky, a landscape of pure white snow. Whenever she does, she'll think she couldn't save Helene, and she couldn't save Sarah, but she can save herself.
And I think, at least for this reader, that felt like a major turning point.
I think you're right.
In the story. About halfway into the book, Shelby decides to go on a dating website.
Yes.
I have never read one of those profiles, so I got a real kick out of the dating profile she came up with. This is on page 139, and I was hoping you would read paragraph 2 until the end, because I think it really gives us spot on an idea of how Shelby sees herself.
All right. This is how she posts herself. 25-year-old woman who carries around guilt, sorrow, and strange desires, looking for a man between the ages of 20 and 35 who knows how to laugh. I would rather run through the park with a bulldog than have a diamond ring. I don't care what you look like, and I hope you don't care about that either. I'm so pale, people think I'm a vampire. I'm not afraid of a fight. I don't drive or wear lipstick. Turn-ons, Chinese food, New York City, fire escapes, lost souls. Turn-offs, people, the past, men who are liars.
Okay. But the website doesn't let her put all of that on.
They don't. They think she'll never get a date if she does that. So they change it, and they change it to unusual woman looking for interesting man, loves Chinese food, long walks, New York City.
Love it. Let's talk about Chinese food is a leitmotif. I guess that's a mixed metaphor. Chinese food is mentioned and consumed often in this story.
Well, she's a New Yorker, so I think that's part of it. And she gets her food delivered, and she's kind of addicted to Chinese food. It's true.
But she doesn't like to open the fortune cookies.
No, she has a great fear of what might be inside the fortune cookie. She's afraid she might get the fortune she thinks she deserves, which is bad.
Which is a healthy sign in a way.
I guess so. You know, I think she has a lot of fear about the future and what the future holds for her. But as it turns out, she really doesn't have much to fear.
No, because she finds herself and her strength. Without spoiling anything, a critical encounter occurs in a tattoo parlor.
Yes.
And this leads to a question about The Illustrated Man. That
yes.
book by Ray Bradbury, that story by Ray Bradbury, has a role, a prominent role in this story.
Yeah.
Did that book have personal significance?
Well, I love that book, but I have to say I love Ray Bradbury. He was the writer that I found when I was 12 years old who changed my life. I think that happens to a lot of people. They stumble upon a book, and for me it was Ray Bradbury. And it wasn't just The Illustrated Man, it was all of his books. And interestingly enough, it was my father who had left the family, and he had left behind one box, and in that box were Ray Bradbury's books.
Uh-huh.
So I felt, you know, I felt that Ray Bradbury was kind of a father to me, a father figure, because his world is such a moral world and such a really good world, even though terrible things happen in it. And toward the end of his life, I got to know him a little bit, which was an amazing thing for me. But in the book, they argue, their big argument is life a book of short stories, an interconnected book of short stories, or is it a novel? And The Illustrated Man was the first book that I read that linked short stories. And it really affected me that you could, you know, it's almost like a novel, but not quite, because characters drop in and out. And I tend to believe life is more like a book of short stories.
And yours are acclaimed. This is a good time. This is kind of a golden age for the short story.
I think so, yeah. I think it's a good time for fiction, actually. I think there's so many people writing great books. And what I love is that people still read books, even though there's so many other options out there. There's still nothing as intimate as a book.
Yeah. I mean, we are our stories. In fact, storytelling, it's a buzzword. A narrative has
right.
become part of popular speech.
It's really true. And, you know, for me, Ray Bradbury was especially important because I never thought I'd have writer's block until I got it. And I got it after 9/11. I felt so traumatized, as so many people did. And I felt like, what was the point of writing? And I went back and read his wonderful book, Fahrenheit 451.
My husband gave me that when we were dating.
Oh.
It was sort of a turning point.
No wonder you married him. I mean, it's the most wonderful book where books are outlawed and people are so devoted to books that they become the book, they memorize the book. And, you know, it's always what you fear will happen in the world, that books will be outlawed. And I think it's just so, I realized how important it is to tell stories. And that it's always been important and it always will be.
What helped you regain your voice?
I think it was reading Ray Bradbury.
That again.
I think it was a book that helped me write a book.
Okay. Well, the story opened with Shelby thinking that she saw an angel protecting her at the accident scene. And in the end, she learns the connection between the mysterious postcards and her angel.
Yeah.
But does she ultimately get the miracle she wants from Helene?
I think she does. But I think it's not really from Helene. I think it's really from herself. I think the miracle she gets is that she's able to forgive herself finally and go on with her life. It's all she can do.
Alice, I read the book a few weeks ago and thought it meaningful that obviously it opened with a passage from some of Leonard Cohen's poetry.
Yes.
And now we've lost him. Would you talk a little bit about that, about your reason for including that?
Well, I think my reason for including it, I thought about it from the very beginning, and I felt like it was really what Shelby needed to know and didn't know. I'm a huge fan of Leonard Cohen's, and when he passed away last Thursday, I was in shock. And I felt so lucky to be able to use this quote, because he never let anyone use anything. And at the very last minute, he allowed me to use it in my book, and it's from his song Anthem, and it says, "Ring the bells that can still ring. Forget your perfect offering. there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. I think that's how he viewed life, and I think that's the truth of life, is that we're all damaged, and we can't help but be broken and damaged. And that's the only way we can advance and understand more of the world and more of ourselves.
Books never let you down and don't judge you. That's spoken by a weird tattoo girl in a bookstore. A wonderful character you created. But I also had the impression that that's your outlook on reading, sort of your manifesto. Is that fair to assume?
It's totally true. You know, lately people have been talking about book therapy as if it's a new thing where a therapist will give you a list of novels to read to help you with your whatever trauma you're going through. But really, I think those of us who love books, we've been doing book therapy our whole lives.
Absolutely. Alice Hoffman, thanks for joining us and for writing books that do not let us down.
Thank you so much.